I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Yeah. Hello and welcome to this. This is the Infrequent Flying Podcast pilot episodes. I'm JB, and as always, I'm here with our three intrepid pilots.
And we're back!
Indeed. Woo-hoo! Well, I'm not going to waste any time, so I'll just get around and introduce people. So first of all, our resident bag of fun, Parky, how are we?
Oh, didn't think you'd be going with me. I thought that would be the resident bag of fun.
I was wondering who that was going to be.
Yeah,
could have been a bag of Botox looking at how young he looks.
The haters, Parky, don't you listen to them? You look fantastic.
Yeah, the Botox is working.
It's the subdued lighting.
His little leathery face. In how many months has it been since we've done this?
Too many.
I think probably easier to measure in years, isn't it?
It's got to be 6 months, isn't it? You've been on the space station for 6 months, haven't you, Goddess?
I can't talk about that.
Anyway, it's not about you two. It's about Parky. Parky, how are you?
I'm all good. The season has finished, JB, so we put the Spitfire to bed. And, I sort of turn into a sort of bear that hibernates and comes out of its cave in about March. So I'm sort of getting my stool already.
It's not really a bear, is it? Come on, it's a lizard.
Squirrel.
Do they hibernate?
You can't really... I mean, I know it's sort of... It's not visual media, but for anyone that hasn't seen Parky, he does not look like a bear.
Where are you going with this, though?
More a small leathery squirrel.
A leathery squirrel, yeah.
Or a buttered otter.
Yeah, maybe it's gone tangential to my ideal introduction, but, you know, we'll go with it.
Excellent. Sorry, mate. And I guess from his Reds days, our resident bag of tricks. Duncan, how are you?
I'm good. I'm also good. I'm delighted that we're back. It's been a long time, hasn't it? And we have, our listeners, well, the same as everyone else, we have a little WhatsApp group. And every so often we say, we should do a pod. We'll do one this week. And then Goddess can't do it because he's very, very busy.
Too high-powered. Far
very
too high-powered.
Busy indeed. But no, things are great. It's good fun. Still flying up at Cranwell. Lots of flying at the moment. So a big smile on my face.
How much flying?
Well, at the moment, twice a day, which is good. A couple of hours a day.
Now, before we continue with the flying, I'm going to give you the opportunity just to plug something. You've been getting absolutely stacked. Tell me about that.
Yes, I can. I've been doing. So, I'll wind back a little. A friend of mine who was on the Red Arrows got in touch with me and said, "Hey, want to raise awareness for the Teenage Cancer Trust, which looks after kids with cancer, clearly." And so it was to do 3,000 press ups in a month, in the month of November. So, I started doing that and decided 3,000. Probably wasn't enough, so we went for 5,000. So I'm getting there now. What's the date today? 24th.
Yep.
So I've got, I think, 200 a day to do to get 5,000 in by the end of the month.
That's a lot of press ups. How are you breaking these up?
No, JB, I've seen him do them. I mean, they literally goes down an inch.
Oh, really? No rep.
No.
There's videos and everything. Oh well, God.
I'll be inspecting these. What are you doing? Breaking them up into sets of 50 throughout the day?
No, I do sets of 30, And yeah, do them throughout the day. I try and do, it depends. I try and do, if I've got time in the morning, I'll try and do 150 in the morning. And then I'll try and do the rest of them sort of in the day at some point, do another couple of sets if I can.
So when you say like sets of 30, you don't just drop down in Tasco and, you know, quick 30 here, quick 30 there.
Exactly, yeah.
During the debrief.
He can't get that low, JB, because his nose hits the ground.
Anyway, hey, probably moving swiftly on, but if we can, we could maybe put a link in. So both of our listeners
absolutely.
Donate.
I think God I can put it in show notes. Yet,
so I'm sure he will at some point. He's very rich.
Indeed he is. Well, talking of Godders, our resident bag of rice, and this will all become very clear shortly. How are we, Godders?
I am very good. On leave this week. Been doing a little bit of working, which Mrs. G is not overly enamoured by. But no, I'm good, and I'm very pleased to see your little faces. And I did actually go flying in a chippy. Probably when did we see each other at dinner, Dunk? About a month ago.
You may be more than that now.
And the magic was still there. It was from Wickenby Parky. Do you remember all of those times we used to blast around the circuit?
Oh,
in Wickenby?
is this the flew-in chipmunk?
Yes.
How
I went
was
flying
it?
With the Fluin. It was brilliant. She's a lovely looking machine, actually, in old BOAC colours. It was flipping brilliant. I loved it. I'd forgotten
all
about
it. Were you very, very scared?
I'm mainly about space travel. No, Blunk was when I was in the back seat and he shouted / screamed, go round on my first landing.
Oh, is she in silver?
Yes.
Oh.
Silver with a blue stripe.
I've got silver with a yellow stripe here.
No, silver with a blue stripe. She's absolutely.
Were you in the back?
Why did he scream go around on your first approach?
Because I think he's just a nervy front seater, that's all.
Oh, he sounds like Mason.
Why did he put you in the back and not the front?
Because I don't think he's checked himself out to captain from the rear. And Parky, you should have seen it. All of those ones where we used to cut the throttle on each other around the circuit there and then side slip it in from somewhere. There I was sideslipping. He went, go round.
Oh.
Off I went to go round. And then immediately in the debrief went, I could have made that, mate.
Hey, what are the flight characteristics? I can't say now. What is flying a chipmunk like? Tell me about it.
JB
can't speak at the moment.
I can't say characteristics. That is that the word I'm looking for? I can't say it.
Characteristics,
thank you.
Yeah, well, so for me, because Dunk did a bunch of times, you did Swinderby, didn't you? And then held it in Edinburgh. But for me, I'd last flown a chippy when I was a cadet, where you just sit there and don't do a lot of flying. The next time was 30-something years later with Parky. And honestly, the first time I landed it, I thought it was like landing a shopping trolley that didn't work. And was there going, oh, I think I'm going to get chopped. But then it turns into the most beautiful aeroplane you could ever fly. I think they're wonderful.
Well, it's not quite the most beautiful aeroplane, is it? Come on.
One of the...
I mean, it is a lovely plane, but we've been lucky enough to fly others.
You have, but is it the difference between driving a supercar and driving something else which is just very nice to drive?
Yeah, it's like a nice Mini. Or
A Beetle, a VW Beetle, something, you know, so a classic, but nothing particularly high performance.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
But the pure flying you can do in that little aeroplane is brilliant. I used to love, well, flying with both of you guys. There was less nibbing when I flew with Parky, but
none taken.
Just the pure flying skills of, you know, you've had an engine failure and trying to simulate you'd get it into that particular field, or as we were talking about, cut the throttle downwind and see if you could make the landing. And there's not a lot of other aeroplanes you've got the time capacity or ability to be able to go and do that in, you know. So actually just testing your pure flying skills with stick and rudder as well, I thought was brilliant.
Did you have a parachute in that one, Goddard?
No, that was the slightly different feeling that you get. And I did think of that when I was in it. And I went, is there a parachute? You went, no, we're not going to go spinning. And at the top of a loop I was doing, I was thinking, well, I better not accidentally put this into a spin because this could be embarrassing.
Yeah, you'd probably be too low if you spun it from there anyway, so I wouldn't worry about it.
No, but exactly.
The reason you didn't get nibbed by Parky is because he had probably no idea what you were doing. He's probably looking out the window at things. Oh, look, horses. Look, I can see some horses.
What, how very dare you.
Did you witness this, Parky?
Did I what?
You didn't witness God is flying, did you?
Yeah, me and Gunners is, we must have shared a few Wickenby moments, you know. It was actually a great little place to fly from because it had a couple of runways, so generally one of them would have a decent crosswind, and, it was just great. It was, the boys have stopped going there now, I think, because of fire cover or something or other, but it was, we most of us cut our teeth up at Swindonby. Wickenby.
He's lost it. He's gone.
Oh, God, I'm in the wrong airfield. Oh, Christ.
Not yeah, JB, it was just a guy I work with. He knows one of the guys who owns that chipmunk up there, and we were up seeing Dunk actually, amongst other people, at the John Egging Trust dinner up at Coningsby a few weeks back. So he took me flying.
Oh, excellent.
And, on a Friday afternoon, which was, like I said, it was flipping brilliant just to go flying again, because I had kind of forgotten about the whole thing. Given space has been such a thrash recently.
Well, interestingly, I had dinner with Flunk, who got us went flying with the night after the John Egging Trust dinner at the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight dinner. And his story was a whole different thing, you know, from Goddard's tale there. He said he was terrified from start to finish. But there you go, you know, I'm sure, you know, you get two different sides of the coin, don't you?
No, yeah. But the interesting thing, Dunk, was that he looked terrified all the way through.
Maybe he was.
Must have been awkward for him, Dunk, because technically he was flying with his boss. Yes. So he must have been...
Yeah.
Oh, he left good,
the very
Goddard.
Last second before he shouted, "No!"
How does one obtain an ex-military aircraft? Are they quite easy to get?
Yeah, they were just in... Buy, you know, chippies on the, on the Knight Aviation, you know, they're up for sale. So they, you know, they're now being G-registered. So they've got a civilian registration.
I see.
And you can, yeah.
So do they have to be G-registered before they get sold?
I think you could buy them and then get them. It's probably easier to have it already done for you. So, you know, stop that. The Norse, but
it was 1992-93 that they all came onto the market, wasn't it, when the Air Force sold them off. And from what I was speaking to one of the other guys the other day, who also has a part share in a chippy, and I think the biggest thing is they've probably dropped in price recently just because of how expensive the engines are, because you can't get hold of the engines these days. Gypsy Major, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Gypsy Major.
Yeah.
2 litre, I think.
There he goes. Off he goes.
So here's the thing, right? So... there are a lot of ex-military aircraft flying around, Spitfires, you know, Warbirds, so on and so forth. You've got the Chippies now. Do you think there's any aircraft that are currently flying that will end up in civilian hands that the military operate? Or do you think they just run them into the ground now, that there's a plan for them, and then when they get decommissioned, well, that's it?
Well, that's an interesting question.
I think you'd be hard-pushed to get... I think the CAA are very wary of, you know, just getting something... very fun, like a Phantom, for example, or you know, a Harrier as a G registered, because of the they would essentially own the risk of that, and that would be a fairly A level thing to prove that you're safe flying it. So I think there would be a problem with that at the moment. But there are Hunters, you know, obviously G registered. So
yeah.
You know, there are swept wing jets that are. But
are there any Hawks G registered?
That'd be a fun one.
I was just thinking about that.
I've kind of heard that there may be one, but is it one at Wharton that's on the G register or something? Don't know.
Maybe, because there's a Nat. So there's Nats around the G registered, of course.
That is cool.
Well, Hawks do fall into the PPL bracket, so you can fly a Hawk on a PPL, bizarrely. Single engine, I think it's 5,700 kilos, isn't it, the weight for a PPL. Anyway, it always used to be the case, but I don't know of any. But you can certainly, JPs are on there. the thing is now is that the Air Force have changed the way they do things. So certainly in training. So back in the day, the Air Force owned all of their chipmunks. Of course, that was a owned by the Crown. But now the Air Force leases its aeroplanes. So the aeroplanes I fly are leased. Although they have a military registration, they're actually a civilian aeroplane. So they could, in theory, once you know that's they've finished flying training with EFT, they could be sold or used by civilian guys.
Because there's some pretty nifty F-18s in private ownership now, and I think that's quite cool.
Yeah, there's some starfighters out in the States.
Yeah,
and that is even cooler, you could argue. I mean, that thing is mental to be gooning around as a civilian.
Is that private though? Because there's a difference now between civilian and, you know, an organisation that operates them. So as you say, JB, there's an organisation. It has all sorts from Albatross. It has F-18s. It has all sorts, and it.
I want to call them Viggen, something like that. Or
you're thinking of Draken.
Draken, that's it. I knew it was named after a Swedish fighter.
Yeah, but the company out in the States, anyway, they sort of package it and go, well, we can give you the most cost-effective platform for what you want to do. So if you want to rent Red Air and you want to have a squadron of F-18s, then we've got a squadron of F-18s. And if you want to do close air support, then we might put, you know, an Albatross with a guy flying it in the front and a forward air controller sat in the back to, you know, help with whatever you want to do. So they package that together. But of course, that is almost certainly run as almost not an airline, but it will be under a registered scheme. It's not a private individual owning that.
Well, in terms of,
I think we're probably fully out of our depth on this particular one, but I'm sure there'll be a listener. There's bound to be listeners being able to tell us. But surely, in order to fly that aeroplane within, whether it's the continental United States or within the UK, you do have to get either the FAA or the CAA to register it, and for you to prove that it's not a danger to the public, you'll have to have liability insurance, all of those sorts of things you would have to do if you owned your own aeroplane. So I think they probably do have to be on the civilian register, because it's only the military that can get a waiver for that by our military registrations.
So I do know that in actual private hands, there is definitely, or there was at least, one Lightning, and there's one Buccaneer in South Africa. I don't know if there's any more of these things. And of course, the Vulcan.
They had an accident, didn't they?
Yeah, they did.
And that outfit shut down.
Oh, did it?
Like, yeah, because it was a two-seat Lightning. Because didn't
Thunder City? Wasn't
That's
it?
The one.
Yeah, that was it. Thunder City. I think it was our friend Professor Brian Cox who went flying in one of those aeroplanes. I think it was the Lightning, or it could have been a Hunter down there. Actually, Dunk. Do you remember that?
I don't. I met a guy that owned it, actually.
I've just sent you a WhatsApp, boys, of the Starfighter. It's suborbital civilian flying training in the States.
Wow.
And they bought a load. I think they're ex-Italian 104s, but I think it'll be civilian registered and you go very high.
Have you ever encountered a 104?
Yes. Yeah, I did a combat against 104s with the Phantom, and we did a squadron exchange to, I'm thinking, Grosseto. But it was, we just flew with the boys regularly, and then we did air combat, a Phantom against a Starfighter. I don't think you'll ever get a bigger fight. It was a cracker.
Well, we tried to do. We fought them in Italy. And we were doing beyond visual range stuff. So we had a controller, you know, telling us where these guys were. And so as it got closer and closer, this thing, it was like, visual. Whew, past it went. It was like, oh, he's gone. That was it. He just kept going. Yeah. He didn't turn.
But they weren't very keen on turning. Yeah.
Oh.
So, no, we did. We fought against them on a Detchi Mamanu, on a detachment down there. And they just cheated like hell. I mean, did they have a tiny little radar on the front of those things?
Yeah.
It couldn't pick up a Harrier for miles. So the pod that we carried that allowed the debrief, the ACMI pod, it's called, Air Combat Maneuvering and Instrumentation Pod, their ground-controlled intercept guys would just use that and would speak to them in cockpit and go, turn left, straight on. They're in front of you 10 miles, you know, 30 miles, 20 miles. They're in front of you. You should be able to see them now, you know. So not actually using any of their own situational awareness. And then they just, as Parky said, wouldn't go into a turn, would allegedly fire stuff at you and then blast straight through going about 12 times the speed of sound on their tiny little wings.
Hang on a minute. Isn't that what they're meant to do? I talk to their ground controller and kill you.
Yeah. But using normally the ground control intercept officer's own radar and everything that brings with it, not using the absolutely, you know, GPS pod numbers.
Oh,
to tell you
sorry,
exactly
I'm with you.
Where they are.
So your GPS pod is saying you're here. Otherwise, they wouldn't know. It is you telling them because of, you know.
Correct. So they're watching the live feed of what's going on using that ACMI debrief and would end up controlling them off of that rather than their radar.
Oh, well, they're only cheating themselves.
I think you could be cheating themselves, JB. You could be very naughty. And if you were firing a Sparrow or something, I don't think the ACMI downlinked exactly where your radar was looking. So if it was in parameters, you would essentially get a kill even if you weren't locked to anything. So you could be a bit dodgy on that. And I can remember very early days. You'll remember this, Goddess. But on the F-16, the button for the gun was a trigger at the front. Whereas that would be for all weaponeering on most British fast jets. And on an ACMI at about sort of 30-odd miles, there would be a little F-16. And they go, stop, you have just taken a gunshot. Any reason? Sorry. Wrong missile, you know, and it was just that. Oh dear, doesn't look brilliant. Some bloke firing his gun at 30 miles before. If you just wait a couple of seconds, the correct thing will come off. There we go. That's it.
My memory's starting to fire up now. Didn't you encounter these guys in Red Flag, Godders? Didn't the Germans bring some out?
No, they brought out some on a Maple Flag. Good memory. Maple Flag. They had some F4s and they had some MiG-29s. And
really?
that was 2000. So the unification in Germany had meant that those airplanes had been in and around Germany for, I guess, 8 or 9 years at that point. But they were moving them around the world and flying as Red Air. So you'd get that realistic Red Air.
Oh, wow.
And they were brilliant to fly against. But normally where you would try and avoid the fight, unless you were in a particular role, if one of these things lit you up, everyone would just turn in and go and try and fight it because you wanted to try and get guns footage on your camera of a MiG-29.
Of course. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So I remember getting spiked, going to the beam, notching, as we called it, so going 90 degrees to it to try and defeat their radar. As soon as the spike went off, pitched back in, only to fight. What was the rule, Parky? No more of 8 in a visual merge? Something along those sorts of lines?
Are you talking non-air combat?
I can't remember the regulation. It was no more than 8 in a visual merge or something.
Oh, sorry, number of aircraft. Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay, yeah, probably.
Yeah. Are you with us, Parky?
He did look like he was dressed up.
Aeroplanes, mate.
I think I gaffed off the number of aircraft in the visual merge rule, to be honest.
So it turned out I wouldn't really
be counting them at that stage.
It turned out that most of Maple Flag had gaffed it off at that particular point as well, because as I pitched in, I saw at least 30-odd aeroplanes all trying to mix it up with these MiG-29s, so just turned away bravely, as I normally do.
Exactly.
Biggest dogfight I ever saw, man.
Hey,
I'm not going in there. I ran away bravely, as you guys know I always do.
Live, survive to get promoted another day, hey?
Exactly.
So, just last question on the F-104. Why do the Americans hate them and the Europeans love them?
I don't think the Americans hated them.
They didn't use them, though, did they? They never bought them. Or very few numbers.
Well, it's because if you have a look at their inventory, over that time that the 104 was being sold, as Parky said, you know, they had tens of different fighters all doing different roles.
Voodoos and all sorts. It was that era, wasn't it, of those
exactly,
kind
100s,
of things.
101s,
104s,
105s.
F4s.
Yeah. And so, but for the Europeans, it's always been the same. When you are buying a fighter,
you commit it's pretty for 30 expensive. Years. Yeah.
Yeah, you commit for a long time, and you can't buy that many of them because we're only small compared to the US. So, you know, for someone like the Italians or the Germans, it was just one of those easy things to buy into. And was it? It was Lockheed, wasn't it? You know, so a big US company. And it's always, you know, the political aspect of these things is also to get links with America and ensure that you're trading with one of the big one of the bigger allies.
Yeah.
That's why I really admire Sweden for what they've done with their own indigenous fighters over the years. You mentioned Draken, but all of those ones have been brilliant from the Saab side of things.
Yeah. Are they going to develop another aircraft, do you think, Sweden? Or do you think they're going to come on board with the UK? Or should we just not talk about that?
No, but
they're still flogging the Gripen, aren't they, at the moment?
Yeah. Yeah, there's an upgrade to the Gripen, which has got an ASA radar. It's probably the same as the F-18 A, B and C compared to the D, E and F models. It's that much of a change with the Gripen. They're pressing with that. And I think they're managing to sell that around various places as well. It's a great bit of kit, the Gripen.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it?
We've been quite geeky this evening, aren't we? Did I black out? Or... So, JB, you introduced Godders with the airing cupboard and the rice.
Yes.
Did I black out? Or did he talk about that?
No, he hasn't. So let me...
Good call, actually, Doug.
Let me introduce that then. So we were thinking about what to talk about, and of course we've just done 25 minutes on F-104s, which is brilliant. But we thought we might just talk about things which have happened in the aviation world. So I guess I'll let Godders talk about this now. What has happened in the aviation world? What was the big story from last week?
Well, the big story from last week was, and there's quite a lot of stuff going on. But one of the big things that we were discussing before we came on air is the crash of the F-35 off of HMS Queen Elizabeth out in the Mediterranean last week, which was a real shame. It is and will be a massively successful deployment. You'll remember I did that job for 3.5 years or so, was integrating everything into the onto the carrier. So to do what they've done, go all the way to the Far East and back again, and then to have that happen just in the Med on the way home is a real shame. But pilot got out, which is great. And we were talking, weren't we, about the fact that there is a bit of a recovery operation as various nations race subsurface towards the wreckage, as I read in the Daily Mail just the other day.
So it's bound to be true.
Yeah, now, when I hear stuff like this, I always think of the Howard Hughes ship, and I can't remember what the hell it's called now, which went to the middle of the Pacific with a big crane in a ship to try and pick up a submarine. Any ideas how they'll try and get this aircraft? Because presumably they want it back.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a marine geographer. There is a word for it.
Geologist?
I don't know. But I don't know. I don't.
A marinologist.
A marine mappist. But I don't know where it happened in the Mediterranean. That's one of the things that they keep highly classified as where the carriers are on a reasonably regular basis, and especially when they're on operations. It's obviously when they're in port. So I don't know where it was in the Med, but I don't think the Med is too deep. I understand it's deeper in certain places. It's not Mariana's Trench deep, but I did hear this was in a slightly deeper area. And honestly, they may have recovered it by now. Again, being in Space Command on a week by week basis, I tend not to hear too much. It's only just stuff I hear off of other guys.
Depth is all relative, isn't it? Because, you know, when you say not too deep,
It's not as if, you know, you paddle in there and it's up to your shins. I think, you know, it's probably...
Well, it is every time I've gone in.
Right up to your shins. So I guess, you know, even if it's only relatively shallow, the job to get it back will be fairly complex, I would imagine.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how... Yeah, how these things work.
It can't be the first time this has had to be done, though, Doug. Surely they've got a plan, right?
Yeah, and you think about what the...
You're right, Parky. They're bound to have a plan.
I'd imagine there's a way of doing it.
Although, check this out. I have just Googled how deep is the Mediterranean Sea. And
I'm going to go 200 metres.
Okay. That's good. Dunk?
3 metres.
Wow.
That's silly. All the boats would be lying on their side, Doug. What do you reckon, Doug? Go more than three. Got two, okay. More than 200 or less than 200?
I'm going to go less than 200, but I'm going to go 150 metres.
Okay, Parco.
I'll go more just to make it interesting. What's the answer?
Well, the average depth is 1,500 metres, almost 5,000 feet, and the deepest point is 5,200 metres.
Wow.
That is
submariners listen to us, they will think we are buffoons.
Well, so I think people think we're buffoons.
Are you sure that that's the average depth?
It says the average depth, according to Mr. Google, is...
1,500
metres, and the deepest point is 5,267 metres, about 3.27 miles in the Calypso Deep in the Ionian Sea.
So as I understand the reason that the Med doesn't have much of a tidal range is because it's quite shallow. So that sounds quite deep to me.
Yeah, but it's all relative, isn't it? So that might be relatively shallow. It's certainly more than over your shins, though, I think.
Yeah.
I think... You might have to hold your breath as you waded in there.
Just on this subject, does anyone know the story about the Yak 28 that crashed?
Is that the one in Berlin?
It is the one in Berlin. Well done.
Yes, only because I read a bloke called George Black, we all know Blackie, it was his dad. So he was Mr. Lightning back in the day, and then he was actually very early on the Harrier, bringing that in. But he did a sort of ground tour in his book, and it just coincided with him being sent out, I think, to Berlin when this thing happened. And the boys, there's some big lakes, aren't there, in Berlin?
Yeah.
And it crashed into one that was technically either on the border or maybe it was in the sort of the Brit-controlled part. And I think that they whipped the radar out, sneaky beaky, got it to Farnborough, had a quick look at it, and then put it back in by the time the Russians then dragged it out.
I thought it all went to... Did it not all go to Farnborough, get deconstructed, and then put on a lorry and sent back?
I need to get the book. I can't believe they had the time to do that. And obviously, the lake wasn't that big that I think the Russians could see. So I think it was all covered up.
Yeah, you're right, actually.
It was definitely... Would it be early... late 50s, early 60s? That sort of time, I'm guessing. Maybe 50s, but absolutely at the height of the Cold War, it's a cracking story.
There'll be a film
on that one, though, won't there?
There definitely should be.
You know, for the recovery of the F-35, again, it'll be James Bond stuff, won't it? You know, there'll be all sorts of submersible vehicles winding their way towards it to try and work out how to get it, or if there's any information they can get from it.
The two-star will be ready with his bowl of rice to dry it out.
Well, there
it is. In the airing cupboard. Big bowl of rice.
Yeah, so that was the discussion about the F-35 being an electric aeroplane, is that once they do get it up, as long as no one turns it on, you stick it in a massive airing cupboard.
There we go.
We could convert a hangar into an airing cupboard. A few tons of rice in there. Don't touch it for a week or so. Nice and warm.
Then it'll
be all right. No, I was just reading the story about that yak that crashed in the lake that you guys are just talking about. It was a fire bar
That's it.
Was it not Brewer?
28. No, it had two big engines on the wings, I think. Quite a swepty wing. What year was it, Goddard?
I'm going to guess 58. No, no, 58. 54. 54, something like that. I'm guessing.
On April the 6th, 1966.
Oh, wow. Much later on.
It was the Havelsee Lake, a lake that straddled the British and Russian sectors of Berlin.
Okay.
This is, I'm not going to read the whole thing. It is an amazing story. The British knew of the Havelsee incident was when a radio operator at Berlin's RAF Gatow picked up a message from the aircraft controllers ordering the pilot to try and land in the lake, but inside the Soviet sector. Despite a valiant attempt, he failed, his aircraft falling short and inside the British zone. Brigadier David Wilson, then head of Bricksmiths, I guess the British mission, was playing squash when the aircraft came down. A quarter of an hour later, still in his shorts, like JB, he was already coordinating one of the most astonishing espionage coups of the Cold War. So the Brits cordoned off the scene, an interpreter sent to the lakeside where the Russian troops were trying to force their way through. The Russians watched as squadron leader Morris Taylor, who unknown to them was the Bricksmith operations officer, rowing to the wreckage to take photos. And there's a ton of stuff in it. Just Google it. It's a phenomenal story. Fascinating.
There's definitely something to do with Farnborough. And
yeah,
sure
there is. You're 100% right there.
Well, and then they throw him back in the water for the boys.
Within minutes, at the same time, technical experts were flown out from the Royal Aircraft Establishment of Farnborough to examine the aircraft's skip-spin radar, which, unlike the Western systems at the time, could look up and down as well as straight ahead. Well, there you go. Down below the water, one British serviceman was trying to get the pilots out of the aircraft so they could be examined by intelligence experts. By 1:45 on the second day, the bodies had been bagged up, and below the water, work was going on to remove the radar. Meanwhile, Major Jeffrey Stevenson, one of the British interpreters, persuaded the Russians that they were still trying to recover the bodies of the crew, that the Russians were suspicious the British might spirit something out under the cover of night, etc., etc. That is brilliant.
Isn't it a good story? So the one which everyone knows about is, of course, the MiG-25 that landed in Japan, which is nowhere near as good as this one.
But in a serendipitous moment, Gatow, that you just spoke about, also had chipmunks at it. They operated chipmunks operationally out of Gatow, didn't they, that we were talking about earlier? And they used to go and do recce over the Berlin Wall.
Is that right?
It wasn't 486. That was there, wasn't it? That was one of those chipmunks.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the ones that we all flew at BBMF actually flew out of Gatow that you're talking about, that this operation happened at, doing recce of the Berlin Wall.
How interesting.
The Americans had the SR-71 Blackbird and we had a chipmunk. with a bloke with a little camera in it. Yeah. And they genuinely did. I knew a mate that flew it out there and they flew around with, you know, just clicking away, getting pictures of guys just, you know, across the other side of the border.
Americans in spacesuits at Mach 3, and then us with Flight Lieutenant George Reynolds. Get the camera, George. Make a picture of that, mate.
Well,
just
it works.
As effective, I think you'll find. probably better resolution pictures of those checkpoints in and around Berlin.
Ah, there speaks the senior officer. Yes, as is best.
So, back to this F-35, right? How are they going to go about replacing this? How easy is that?
Well, normally, when you buy fighter aircraft, well, you buy anything, but from a fighter perspective, they'll have a attrition spares that come along with it. So they'll, just like the... They'll know from how many years we've operated single-engine aeroplanes, so on, what the reliability of the aeroplane is. And they'll know every now and again something like this is going to happen. In wartime, you're going to lose some aircraft as well. So
we must have bought a lot of extra Harriers.
Well, we were talking about just this the other day because it was a bit of a shock to hear a Brit had ejected from an F-35 when, I'm touching wood, in all of these years of typhoons, whilst there have been a couple of fatalities, but there hasn't been a Brit that has ejected from a typhoon.
Is that right?
Whereas when Duncan and I were on the Parker, when you were studying around in F4s and F3s, people we knew were jumping out left, right in Chelsea, weren't they? And certainly in the Harrier, we went through that period in the 90s, Dunk, when all of us thought it was us next. Because we'd had about 6 in 6 months or 6 in 4 months or something.
It must have been quite a surprise when you actually landed.
Yeah, well, it was a bit of a surprise.
I spent 5 years on the Harrier and was incredibly surprised that I'd managed to survive it or, you know, not jump out by the time I left.
Crikey. Wasn't the Harrier story more to do with inexperienced US Marines flying it rather than experienced Royal Air Force personnel?
I don't think so. I think the fact is, you know, we had just as inexperienced guys. The way that the Americans did it was slightly different to us. And without blowing our trumpets, the fact is that we recognised that it was a complicated aeroplane to operate, off different surfaces and aircraft carriers, etc., etc. And therefore, the guys that are generally done better in flying training would get sent to the Harrier.
I see. And then
where did you go, Paul?
Here we go.
Oh, God.
It is true, whereas the Americans didn't look at it that way. I think they just, you know, people would just get sent in different ways. In fact, they may have even done it the opposite way. God, as you'll probably be able to give a bit more insight, having been out there. But they certainly lost a lot of guys on the Harrier, perhaps more so than we did, and perhaps because of that reason.
I think early on, though, in the older Mark of Harrier, though, because as we got to GR5, GR7, GR9, there were...
Anybody could fly those, right?
Well, yeah, exactly.
Wouldn't a lot of them have just been, you know, bird strikes, you know, single engine, operating constantly at low level, pretty much? You know, that's just a high risk. I mean, that was a big intake, wasn't it, that the Harrier had? I imagine burst strikes must have accounted for a fairly high percentage of the boys.
Certainly some. That was a bird strike. Dano, who we were doing an exercise out of in Norfolk, and he ejected. So that was a bird strike as well. There's a number of bird strikes, but
Ned, what was Ned's one up at Lossie?
I can't remember.
Bird strike as well. I think you're probably right. It's that single engine thing, JB.
Oh my God. I'm just counting up the losses now. 74 losses of Harriers I'm on so far. I'm not even into the 90s yet. And this is British Harriers. That's remarkable. Mind you, there was a war as well.
I can remember, JB, when I rocked up on a flight safety day. The Dutch had a flight safety day at one of their sort of bases, and all the boys came to it. I think it was like at Vokel in 95 or something or other, and the Americans were there, and they just went through sort of crashes, and I don't think the Dutch had had one, maybe the Belgians had lost one, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then they gave a book of the crashes. It was like, well, there's hundreds in this thing. And that was, and I thought, I guess that's of the F-16 flying, it had been around for 20-odd years, and that was 1 year's worth of F-16s. And they were all American. And it was probably, you know, ours, the ratio wasn't probably that different of the four nations of the, you know, the Danes, the Norwegians, the Dutch and the Belgians. But they just had so many aircraft.
Get this.
And they flew so many times. And, you know, it was 50-odd that they lost in that year. I'm sure it was extraordinary. But there you go.
16 out of 31 Indian Navy Sea Harriers were destroyed in crashes. That's remarkable.
Yeah, it is, yeah. You got a 50-50 chance, boys. Good luck.
Wow. Wow. That kind of brings home the risk, though, to be fair.
But there's another stat that came from that book that I was mentioning, that George Black, he joined, and I think in 1952, the RAF lost 150 metres in 1 year. And, you know, it generally, as he sort of rocked up to do his OCU, there was, you know, had to wait in the bus because there was a funeral going on. And I think three of his guys got killed on his OCU course on the meteor. But that year, he kind of, there's a sort of slip about the stats. And, you know, there's things like seven Lancasters were lost, and there's some Mosquitoes, and hundreds of aircraft were lost that year. To such, I think Churchill was the Prime Minister again, and he wrote to Kaz, the boss of the Air Force, sort of dismay, you know, voicing his concerns about, in civilian times, the number of aircraft. And the boss of the RAF wrote back and said, remember who won the Battle of Britain? And that was that sorted. So,
done. It is risky business.
JB, it's an interesting point, though, isn't it? In that I mentioned the fact that it was a bit of a shock. Well, it was a shock to hear that we'd lost an F-35 the other day. I think there's something like close to 700 F-35s flying around the world now. So it just, in a single-engine aeroplane, it just demonstrates how, A, they're more reliable than they ever used to be, and B, they're relatively straightforward to fly.
Yeah.
Because a lot of those old, the Indian Navy ones operating in and around carriers with single-engine aeroplanes, the VSTOL, the vertical short takeoff and landing side of things, is really tricky. Whereas you get into an F-35, it's straightforward. You know, you made the point that anyone can do it, and anyone can do it, I think. And so that's probably what it is. That's why it was such a shock.
The boss of 3 Squadron, when we were operating, when Dan Johnson ejected up in Scotland, which was a bird strike that we were speaking about, was a field exercise out of one of the old airfields in Norfolk. And Des Dazoni, who was the boss at the time, came in and said, well, boys, operation this size, bound to lose a few. So, and I guess that maybe applies to, you know, the carriers, deployment that it's just been on this time. Well, you know.
I think it is worth noting, though. I mean, the F-35 today is a remarkably safe aircraft. And actually, just before we say, I'm going to ask a separate question. Is it safe because it is intrinsically safe? Or is it safe because you're doing all of your training in simulators now?
Ooh, well, that's a good question, I think. And, you know, the fact is, it's probably safer because if you compare, it's a much like the F-16s that Goddard was talking about in terms of flying hours. The number of flying hours they'll have done with it is enormously reduced compared with, you know, back in 60s, 70s, 80s and even 90s when synthetic training was far, far less.
Yeah, so, but accident rate per flying hour, Dunk, I reckon Typhoon and F-35 have got to be well impressive compared to, you know, the likes of the Harriers, even F-3, F-4, you know, that sort of era.
I'm sure you're right. But I don't mean to poo-poo it. But, of course, F-35 hasn't been flying that long, so it hasn't got that, you know, it hasn't got any sort of longevity to its service life so far for us to be able to look at that.
Yeah, but I think the same thing, if you'd have looked at the same point with, well, I don't even know whether we got to 700 Harriers in the world. We probably didn't. The same point in the service life, I guarantee we'd have lost a massively high percentage more of other fighters along the way. And you're right. We mentioned Typhoon there as well. Massively reliable when it comes to it.
I don't know. After the flow one.
Buck is not even listening. He's just staring at me.
Yeah. No, you know, it was. I remember I had the first engine failure ever, you know, in a Typhoon. I remember just left engine flame, you know, she had a little nag at you. And I remember thinking, utter disbelief. Like, oh, God, this can't be real, you know. Whereas it was, I wouldn't say commonplace in F3, F4, but, you know, you chuck engines down, you know, a fair bit, you know, every now and again. But it was just so good grief. I remember telling my wingman, my left engine's flame, I didn't believe it. Better go home. You know, it was just, it was surreal. But
So what was wrong with it, Parker? What is it? Did it just flame out?
Yeah, it was a very early doors, and it was the inlet guide vanes hadn't moved. And as I went through 15,000 feet, I guess they should have moved to a certain angle, you know, to allow a nice flow into the engine, and it basically starved the engine. So, you know, in a way, I guess it only happened on one side. I don't, you know, the other one was obviously good. It was just that computer on that left-hand engine. And it was very one of those very strange things at the time. Goddard's was fairly early doors onto it, you know, it would light up like a bit of a Christmas tree, the central warning panel. And when I then, and so I got a left engine oil pressure and, you know, various bits on the captions, as soon as I put the throttle in the off position, all the captions disappeared. And that was completely serious. Like, I don't think I've ever flown with no caption and I'm single engine. And then
everything's fine.
You're yeah, very, very, very strange that was. And then it used to have phase of flight. They've probably tweaked it a little bit now. But then when I landed and the main was like, even the nose will touch down and it went into ground phase of flight, that central warning panel lit up like a Christmas tree, which is probably not what you wanted to happen, you know, just on landing, quite distracting. But
no.
Yeah, I can. I remember that sort of. It was one of those that, you know, there were the guys actually quite interested to see, just to check that the sim was giving the correct captions, if you see what I mean.
Oh, how cool.
But now you mentioned, you mentioned IGVs as well. I think, you know, we lost certainly a number of Harriers through IGV problems as well, because it was pretty sensitive to that.
IGV?
Yeah, I think they're quite important.
Yeah.
IGV?
Yeah, so don't, you're going to have to...
Inlet guide vanes.
Ah, got it.
Yeah, so it as the name suggests, it literally is at the air intake. It guides the air in the correct flow onto the compressor, so that it the engine works properly.
Yeah, so I only learned about this relatively recently. But though, for those who are thinking, like, still, what are you talking about? Are those the basically the cone things that you see on like a Mirage 3, and they go in and out?
No, those are the ramps.
Oh. So,
most, you know, back in the day, I think even back to the Starfighter, but then when that thing was first rolled out, they kept the intakes completely covered because it was a bit of a giveaway. You could almost work out the speed of an aircraft by how the ramps would move and deflect and those bits there. But I think this is something that's further inside, just right at the, just before the compressor stage.
Ah, interesting.
So, yeah, if they failed, that was it. Engine didn't work.
Did you get it restarted, or did you just go home?
No, bizarrely as well, it had an auto relight, and the igniters that we then had to check again that they were working. I think you could check them downstairs as well on the panel. But one of those had burnt out, so it wouldn't relight. So I had one light, it had two igniters, and one had got the engine going in the first place. And then that had burnt out on start, bizarrely. So it was a sort of, yeah, great trip for me. Really, really serviceable aircraft, that one.
Crikey.
How early was that when you were on 29 early doors?
Yeah, it was at Coningsby. So I think that would have been 2005.
But yeah, didn't they have?
There was a couple of early teething problems happened then. It was, remember, Flunk, the guy that I went flying with in the Chipmunk, ended up landing nose wheel up, which was quite spectacular.
Bravo Juliet, the aircraft that hated humans, because I think we'd done the lightning trial on it, and they zapped it with a billion volts or something, and ever since that it didn't like humans. And after they'd fixed that spark down the runway, we all went out to watch as a Eurofighter landed without a nose wheel, and it sort of, you know, did a great job and sort of held off. It was Ferg was flying it. I think Flunk was in the back from memory. And he helped sort of held it off and then gently just popped the nose down and then saw a few sparks. But the four ADTs that measure the angle of attack and temperature and the sensors are basically four bits of metal. They all sit under the chin and they all pinged off and went down both engines before we could sort of shut them down. And boy, did they go through the engines and make a lot of sparks and bangs. And, yeah, it was quite impressive for a bit. But they got that thing flying again. I did the air test on that thing. They sort of wheeled it out, the aircraft that hated humans. And it was like, oh, I think we should give up on this one. No, we fixed it. Off you go, Parky. And I'm sure he never liked me very much.
Well, hated humans, but clearly had a soft spot for leathery squirrels.
Hey, talking, because, you know, Goddard's and I think have only ever flown, well, you've done Typhoon, I suppose, but up until then single engined only. But the F3, that could have, if it had a back end engine fire,
There was something that was it. You were doomed. Both engines were doomed, weren't they? Even though you had two. Wasn't that right? That there was something.
Yeah. It was uncontrollable and, hitting the fire bottles and all of that stuff. It was just an uncontrolled fire. We ended up having a speed of the day. The F3 boys will remember that they worked out it happened at very high speed, and you go supersonic at low level in the F3 quite easily. And you know, they somehow worked out that they would then go, it's a hot day today, and blah blah blah. The speed of the day, do not go above 760 knots or something. You know, it was like that, and that was to try and stop that.
Wow.
But it was you're badly placed because generally they were very high speed ejections. The boys got out of it, but obviously that's not a great thing to do.
Was that because the...
Because.
Was that because the boys, you know, that fire was so intense that they couldn't then, you know, shut them down, get the nose up, reduce speed before ejecting? Was it, right, get out now?
I think it was, yeah, it was fairly...
Oh, I bet. Did it have something to do with a tailplane? Would it burn through tailplane?
Well, yeah, wasn't Stu Smiley
one of those? Wasn't he a high speed? I think Stu was a. We need to get him on and talk about his ejection, but I think he was a rear end fire in an F3 boy.
I mean, I might be talking because the Hawk. If you had one of the GTS fires, if you had a GTS fire, that could you had to go and loiter in the overhead. In case it burnt through, and then
GTS dunk for the non-Hawk listeners.
The gas
turbine starter.
Yeah, gas turbine.
Crikey, I could have guessed all day and not got that. Oh yeah, the GTS fire. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, little engine.
No, it's the Hawk Gran Turismo Sport.
Yeah, such an accessible podcast, this isn't it? The GTS fire.
I can remember that emergency dunk, and it was the control rods were about there, wasn't it? And if you just basically you would. No, it hasn't burned through those. I'll now land.
Yeah, you loitered. If the caption went out, I think you loitered for 10 minutes. And if it stayed on for 20, and then you landed and hoped for the best. But if it went, it was an uncontrollable pitch down. That was what it was. I think I'm remembering right. Something like that, anyway.
Yeah.
But talking of things going through the engines, there was one, JB, where one of the guys on one squadron on the Harrier... on the seat where you clip your oxygen and radio it's called a personal equipment cover, isn't it, or personal equipment connector, the PEC. So you would clip when you get into the aeroplane, you'd connect that, and it had your oxygen, your G suit hose and your radio stuff that were then connected to you, and the oxygen and the air would come to the G suit. So when you to avoid dust and everything going down the holes when no one was sat in the aeroplane, there was a thing called the PEC cover, which is quite a big old thick bit of metal. It was this cover with a lever on the back that you just clip into it and lock it down. And for whatever reason, this had been left on right on the shoulder of the Harrier that this guy was getting into. It was, you know, just take it out, put it on the side. Right, I'll get that in a second. And it was forgotten about. And he got onto the runway, and as he went full power, the auxiliary intake doors on a Harrier opened, and this thing then went down into the engine.
Oh,
and essentially, it looked like one of those Tom and Jerry corn on the cobs after they'd finished it, as it shaved, as this big bit of metal then shaved all the blades as it went all the way through the engine. And it was miles, wasn't it? Just... completely lost all power up at around 100 knots and ended up aborting. And I think only going a little bit off the runway, unlike my spectacular. but ended up coming to a halt. And then this engine looked like sort of half an engine down the intake.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, so, you don't want...
What would his CO say about that? Just give me a flavour of that conversation.
Well, same as my one, and I've told the story before, but they run an investigation and have a look at exactly what happened, why it happened. It's interesting. These days, you run through a set of standard tables to see, you know, pilot error, avoidable, all the way through to sort of criminal damage, and then the same on the I'm not going to call it punishment, but the what to do, whether it's minor administrative action all the way through to court martial.
Are we talking about the pilot equivalent of the high tackle framework?
Yeah, I think you're right. The high tackle framework, for everyone listening, it being the thing that the referees go through religiously in a rugby match to understand whether they're going to yellow or red card. No, you're right. It is exactly that.
There we go.
And
was there a high degree of incompetence? Was there damage?
So it's exactly that. And the reason there is that framework there is to provide consistency for everyone. So rather than a particular CO making a judgment saying, right, you screwed that up, I'm taking you offline for the next 6 weeks, or that could have happened to anyone, you're back flying tomorrow.
Ah, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. I like it.
There we go. Feel free to use that on any of your subordinates.
Thanks, JB.
It's okay. Hey, boys.
I haven't got any subordinates anymore.
Hey, well, boys, we've been doing it for an hour, which is all that I'm contracted. But is it a silly question to ask? Are there any historic questions that we've not answered, Godders?
Oh my goodness! Right, you talk amongst yourselves. Shows how much we talk about what we're going to do. I'm going to go and look at the pod online and see what questions are out there.
But of course, interesting to say. So, talking about, you know, what we've what God has just mentioned, that how we prepare for this is we don't. So we literally just
they never know.
I know. We rock up, but it's interesting the directions we go in, isn't it? You know, that suddenly we've kind of sparked from chipmunks to then aircraft losses and how engines fail, all the way through from sort of past to present day.
Yeah,
it's quite good. There's quite a lot of stuff in here saying how people miss us. Well, two, but I'm going to say quite a lot.
I've had at least two asking when we're back recently.
My dad's been asking.
There we go.
Hello, Dad.
Well, I even heard Phil on Egg Chaser say, "Oh, excellent."
So, oh, is it? I don't know.
Does Phil
fan.
Actually listen? Hello, Phil. Good to see you. Good to see you the other week at North Dorset Sevens. We didn't talk about that when we saw each other.
Indeed. Yeah, I went down to Exeter the other week to play in Sunday Park. And my plan was to come off the road, not off the road as such, and go to the Fleet Air Arm Museum. Sadly, I was too early. It wasn't open. So I had to go back on the motorway and over to Chiefs.
Oh, that is a shame because it is a good museum, actually.
Yeah, really,
the Yeovilton.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really desperate to go.
Yeah, that is good. I guess, you know, we haven't been able to, there hasn't been any excursions to those sort of things because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
Is there really? So there's been, I guess they've been suffering.
If only we knew someone who had an air display team or something that we could interview or go and see. That'd be a really cool podcast.
We have got quite a few people lined up, haven't we? I know we've been relatively unorganised this time, but, you know, if we can get Goddess to have a day's leave again, because otherwise we'll never pin him down.
Unlikely.
We want to get the blades. We want to get the blades on, don't we? That would be quite interesting.
Yeah, no, we definitely need to speak to the 2XL team. But on questions, there's one back from last year, and I don't remember... It's Ailes G, who often asks us questions, so that's brilliant, thank you. As in, questions about you've been in an emergency, your favourite emergency ? What emergency situation did you learn the most from? What's your favourite emergency equipment item? We definitely have not talked about that one before, have we? That's a great question.
Favourite emergency.
Yeah, I'm smiling at the favourite emergency.
Well, I really enjoyed that one. It was a bell.
Yeah, when the wing fell off. Oh, I loved it.
I
had an engine failure over Mostar, I remember, doing some... we just
told us about that one.
No, different one.
Different
helicopters at low level.
Oof.
But, yeah, that was... and it Mostar in Bosnia. Went blank. Yeah, that was a goodie.
Did it make a lot of noise?
It was definitely a bang. I remember just, you know, when you look in and the engine's gauges are definitely in an unhappy place. It was a are shutting down. F3 was very clever. The Typhoon. If you lost one engine, you could have a cross drive clutch, so you could drive all the ancillaries that engine would drive from the other engine. So it was very clever in that respect. But it was just a bit gutless, the old girl on one engine. And clearly we had to fly back across the Adriatic, whatever it was, on one engine. But that was quite good. That was a different one.
My favourite emergency is... So I'd gone to Germany in the sort of mid-90s. And we used to come over to Holbeach to go to the range. We used to fly over from Germany to go to Holbeach to do low-level bombing. And because it was winter, wore an immersion suit, and I'd put my flying suit in my locker, put my immersion suit on anyway. I hit a bloody great big seagull at 100 feet, so I had to divert into Wittering. It made a hell of a mess of the right-hand side of the aeroplane. And I diverted into Wittering, and I'd had a blind date about a month before with a young lady, and I didn't have any clothes because, of course, I was based in Germany. I didn't have my wallet because it was still in my flying suit that I'd put in my locker.
Dunk, that is not the reason you don't take your wallet around the place.
But I managed to find the number of this girl and give her a call, borrowed some clothes off a mate, rang her up and said, I don't know if you remember me, but I haven't got any money. If you come and fetch me, how about we go to the pub? And she's now my wife.
Oh, thank God for that.
I'm the same as you, JB.
Serious question. Do you actually mean
Hang on. She only married him because she is still waiting for him to pay her back.
Exactly.
For that evening.
When you say a blind date, Doug, do you mean an old school, you were meant to meet there, never met her before, blind date?
Yes, so I'd met her once before.
Wow. That is really a sign of the times. I think they must have died out with internet dating.
Yeah, they probably did, didn't they? They probably did.
They don't happen anymore.
Yeah.
See, anyway. I can't top that. You know, I've had a few emergencies along the way, but I think my most recent one was declaring a mayday over the middle of Paris and having to descend from 38,000 feet to below 10,000 feet immediately with an oxygen failure in a typhoon, which was quite exciting as they moved all of the air traffic in France away from me. And then when I got below 10,000 feet, everything was fine. I can't even remember what, Park, you might remember what type of emergency it was. Maybe a front.
I think it was you used to get an oxy in the alternate oxygen bottle, the AOB. Do you remember? It either wouldn't fire or it was.
Yeah, it was something like
about the AOB, which should have gone off and then it had depleted itself or something or other. But if you had it, you knew that you weren't on the AOB, which should be working. But they fixed that one eventually. But there was a few of those early days, boys. Descending all over the shop.
French air traffic were brilliant. Got everyone out of the way, said, what assistance do you need? And once I was below 10,000 feet, I essentially went, I think I'm all right now. I'll just carry on.
Feeling okay?
Two questions.
I'm feeling all right now.
What were you doing over France? Who were you with? What were you doing? And the other one is, was it like, was the emergency you had no oxygen?
He was going to see Dunk's French wife.
It was a blind date in France.
With the cash that he owed her. I was flying back with a young wingman, having delivered an aeroplane out to Cyprus when I was station commander at Lossiemouth, and taking another aeroplane back. So the way out had been fairly straightforward. We landed in Grosseto in Italy, and then actually made it in a single shot from Italy to Cyprus. On the way back with a headwind, and no tanker. In fact, I don't think we had a tanker on the way out. We ended up landing it in Crete, then again in Italy, then at Coningsby, and then up to Lossiemouth. So it was a fairly long day. So we'd had a couple of issues along the way, and this was the final straw as we ended up heading downhill over the middle of Paris with this young wingy thinking, oh, this is not what I needed. And I'm asking him to get the cards out and double check what I'm doing.
So,
but yeah.
I imagine that being so much more glamorous than it actually was. I imagine two fighter pilots nipping into Italy for some fuel, quick espresso, back in the cockpit and gone again. But it's not like that, is it?
I remember when we landed in Crete, actually, it was warm. we're wearing immersion suits. It was a massively quick turnaround because the day was against us. We were losing time and we had to be back by dark. Well, we had to be back within 12 hours. Otherwise, there was an extension to the flying day. And when I got him, because I was more experienced, I got him to start up first. And Park, you'll remember it, he'd had an inertial nav failure, which meant you had to get underneath the aeroplane as it was running and flick about 1,000 different circuit breakers
to get this thing
back up and running again. And I was sweating like you read about, because I'm in my full kit rolling around underneath this this aeroplane in the middle of Crete before I then even got into my own and fired her up, because as they called it, an autonomous start, it's not fraught with danger, but it's a lot less easy than when you've got a big power set connected and so on. You have to start the auxiliary power unit, get everything fired up. Then you have to start the engines and make sure all the avionics are working and so on. And it's just, if you're not experienced in these things and you know some of the switches or in what order to do stuff, it can be a little bit tricky. So it was an interesting day.
That is interesting. Right, any more for any more? Because I'm having a horrible allergic reaction to cats down here. So
on that bombshell.
On that bombshell, she did say, what's your favourite emergency equipment item? And actually, I think mine is the magic straw.
Go on.
So that's it's in our survival packs. There's a thing
called I know what it is.
Yeah, a reverse osmosis pump, which is one you can stick in seawater. You know, I think it was squeeze the thing, wasn't it? And then you get drinking water out of it. But the magic straw was just a straw with magic stuff in the middle. You could stick it in anything, and you'd be drinking pure, clean water out the other end when you sucked it up.
There must be a few drinking games involving magic straws.
Yeah, I wonder if it takes alcohol out. That'd be the way to do it,
wouldn't it?
Well, would it? If you put alcohol in, that's the way to do it.
Well, if the two stars driving and he's ming-monged, it could be useful.
Give me my magic straw of my pint.
It would be a really dull drinking game, though, wouldn't it? Right, drink through the magic straw. Still sober. Jesus Christ,
well, you say that, Doug.
Of whiskey.
See, you say that, Doug. And I disagree with you here, because my dream is to do a stag do. And the fine for the stag is he's not allowed to drink for the whole thing. It'd be so miserable.
Well, you know.
Or even better, don't even take him. Leave him in the airport. The gag is he doesn't get to go.
Yeah, I'm not sure how well that's going to go down.
Well, that's a point, isn't it? Making memories and all that. Anyway, I've had enough of this. I can hardly breathe.
I can tell. You can't breathe.
I can't breathe.
Your wife's a doctor.
Exactly. Can you tell everyone where they can find us on Twitter, please, Goddess?
I'm looking at it right now. It's Pilot Episodes at Pilot Episodes Podcast. We look at it every now and again, don't we? I'm kind of off Twitter these days, but I do check this out every now and again. Do a bit of stalking. Maybe we can talk about why I'm not necessarily on Twitter these days in the next one. Let's leave.
I would love to do that.
It's quite a funny story.
Well, we've had a bit of a hiatus, haven't we? I guess. What have we been off for about 6 months? We were saying we should try and be a little bit more regular now the winter's come around.
Pre-Christmas.
Yeah. Well, let's not overcommit and under-promise.
Yeah,
pre-Christmas 2022.
Pre-Christmas Santa special.
We might even get a guest.
Yeah, I guess it'd be good because you have some belting guests. Anyway, enough of that.
This has been good. It's probably been rubbish listening, but I've enjoyed seeing your little faces again.
Yes.
How nice has this been?
It's been a welcome change from my normal dreary Wednesday. I'll give you that much.
Right, Jamie, you've got to get up for CrossFit in the morning.
Absolutely, I do. Right, well, that's enough of that. Thank you very much, gents. So we will leave it there. Hopefully we'll be back in the very near future, or the semi-near future, or maybe even the far future. But one of those three things will be true. So from me, Dunk, and Parky, thank you for listening, and goodbye.
And me.
Bye.
Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays.
Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.